Spider-Man's origin has a beginning, middle, and an end. I mean, you could probably just do a movie about him learning that with great power comes great responsibility and not even get any supervillains involved.
After the credits roll, there's always more to tell. Especially when the video sales are doing really well. From Shock Treatment to Jason X to Police Academy 6. This is Sequel Cast, and they are unsurpassed at following a franchise until the bitter end. This is Sequel Cast, and your hosts have asked that I inform you that the show will now begin.
The theme song to the Sequel Cast is written and performed by Mark with the C. You can check out his albums at markwiththec.com. And now we take you back to the Sequel Cast.
And your hosts have asked that I inform you that the show will now begin.
Hello and welcome to Sequel Cast Specials, a specific kind of show, a spinoff of the Sequel Cast show, in which we talk about we talk about movies in a broader sense. The Sequel Cast, much like Sequel Cast Specials, is available at sequelcast.com. But the Sequel Cast, we focus on movies in a franchise, one movie at a time. Sequel Cast Specials, we kind of zoom things out a bit, look at things from a broader perspective. Looking at a franchise in a whole, for example, as opposed to film by film.
Or special topics.
Or like special topics. Episode. Right, like we did one about, you know, movies released in theaters in 2011. And some of those are sequels and some of those weren't. But the Sequel Cast specials give us a little bit of to breathe, try a little bit different topics about the world of film. With me is Thrasher.
Hello, everybody.
Check out the website, sequelcast.com. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/sequelcast. And you can also check us out on Stitcher. Look us up on Sequelcast on there. And if you go to iTunes and find us on there, please leave us a review. We have sponsors. You go to sequelcast.com, look on the left. You'll see some of the links. We're an Amazon affiliate. So if you click on the Amazon.com graphic, next time you go shopping for Amazon, we'll get a little cut of that, and that helps pay for production cost of the shows. In addition, you know, if you go to Stitcher.com/Sequelcast and sign up for Stitcher, which is an app that lets you listen to shows for podcasts for free streaming on your smartphone or a desktop or a laptop computer, you get a chance to win $100 American. That's Stitcher.com/Sequelcast. Now, this special Sequelcast episode, we'll be talking about movies based on Marvel Comics, and it's loosely inspired by the Avengers movie, which had come out by the time you've watched this. But we'll kind of talk about different experiences we've had, because there's been a lot of movies based off of Marvel comic books. Right, Thrasher?
Oh, quite a few.
Yes, and if you want to look along with us, we're looking at a site at en.wikipedia.org/wiki/list of films based on Marvel Comics. Just look up wiki list of films based on Marvel Comics on Google and you'll find it.
It's even easier than that. You can just type Marvel films.
In Wikipedia, yeah. That's probably the easiest. Good going, Thrasher.
No problem, man.
But you had a theory you wanted to talk about, but before that...
It's not a theory. It was at one point an immutable law of the universe until it became mutable.
Yeah, okay. But let's start talking about what is the first Marvel film based off of Marvel comic that you saw in a theater? For me, it was Blade in 1998. I went with a buddy of mine. We were like sophomores in high school at the time. I didn't really want to see it, but I was dragged along to it. We almost walked out of Blade halfway through to go see Wrongfully Accused with Leslie Nielsen instead. We kind of hopscotched between the two movies in the theater at the time, if you can believe that. And Blade, you know, at the time it was sort of cashing in on the combination of the Hong Kong action film influence And, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a popular TV show based on a movie about vampires and was cashing in a bit on that as well, although Blade was a comic character from the 70s that was in an issue of the Marvel Tomb of Dracula comics. Very good. And in the Tomb of Dracula comics, Blade was more of like sort of like a Shaft takeoff. Where he's like, what you doing, Dracula, motherfucker? I'm going to fuck you up. Except they didn't use the word fuck.
No, it was comics code approved, so he never would have sworn, but...
I'm going to mess you up real fierce, Dracula.
This was the height of blaxploitation cinema.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of that in the original version of Blade. You know, I believe in his first appearance, he refers to Dracula as being a jive sucker.
No, I think you're right. I've read some of those reprints in the Marvel Essentials black and white trades that they've come out with over the years, and I really enjoy the art style of those Tomb of Dracula comics. Real nice detail, I think. Even if the reprints are in black and white, sadly, but that's a cut on cost.
It doesn't hurt the art, I find.
No, in some cases it actually helps it. Some of the colors of comics in the 70s or 80s look garish today. So, Thrasher.
They were garish even then. It was just fashion at the time.
Thrasher, what was the first Marvel comic movie you saw in the theater?
It was Blade,
okay,
which I just devoured. That is still one of my favorite comic book movies, and just one of my favorite adventure, sci-fi, horror, whatever the hell genre it has bent itself into kind of movies. Originally, the first Marvel film I was going to see in the theater was The Fantastic Four, but that version of the Fantastic Four was never widely released.
You can only find it on, like, the comic convention bootleg circuit. It was produced by New Horizons, the production company at the time of Roger Corman.
Yeah, well, the whole reason that film was made was to not settle, but to shore up a possible copyright dispute. The people who had the film rights to the Fantastic Four, it was the term of the contract that they signed with Marvel to get the film rights stated that if they did not produce a film within a certain time period, the rights reverted back to Marvel, and then Marvel could sell them again. And these people, the people who had the rights, didn't want to give those rights up. So in order to hold on to the rights, which turned out to be a smart thing to do because Blade did make comic book movies much more viable again, is that they... It's depending on who you say or who you talk to, a year and a half to less than a year got Roger Corman's production company to churn out that movie just so they wouldn't lose the film rights. And the thing is, like, you can tell they're really trying. They just don't have the resources needed to really bring the Fantastic Four to life.
I think the theme makeup isn't really that bad in that movie.
Yeah, the thing looks good. I mean, all the characters look and act just like the characters in the classic Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Fantastic Four comic books. But anytime they really need to use their superpowers, you can start to see all of the scenes, and it becomes very unflattering.
It was supposed to have a budget of $40 million and ended up only having a budget of like $1.5 million, so
yeah.
But it was meant to be a major theatrical release. That just never happened.
Well, it was released in theaters because I believe that was part of the contract, but I think it was only released in one just to meet the contract's requirement.
So what is your theory, Thrasher, on the Marvel movie curse?
Well, it used to be what we in the comic book fandom community called the Mighty Marvel movie curse, which is simply that if you tried to turn a Marvel comic book into a movie, it would only make a terrible movie.
Hmm.
And Blade was the film that broke the Mighty Marvel movie curse. Up until then, the only... Because even going... And I'm not counting the Captain America serial from the 1940s, because Marvel as an entity did not yet exist. Captain America is a character that predated Marvel and the Marvel Universe as we understand it. But if you look back at every Marvel movie that came out before Blade, they're all terrible and forgettable. The Fantastic Four, which we just mentioned, the 1990s Captain America, the Punisher with Dolph Lundgren, Howard the Duck, which I bet we could do a whole episode on. Even a whole series of television movies. Namely the Captain America television movies, where it has nothing to do with Captain America. He's basically a an evil Knievel type stuntman who goes after organized criminals.
Well, and there was a trilogy of sorts of direct-to-TV movies spun off of the Incredible Hulk TV series.
Yeah, they're okay, but they're... Marvel has always been a bit epic and a bit over the top, and so, like, if... for instance, in one of those movies, the Incredible Hulk meets Thor, but you don't really get to do any cosmic god-type stuff with Thor.
Well, in another one, it's called The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, but the trial sequence is just like a dream that the character has.
Yeah, although Stan Lee is in the jury of that trial, which I believe makes it the first Stan Lee Marvel movie cameo. Now, that being said, I mean, as I said, these movies are of low quality. They are very forgettable. That being said, the Doctor Strange TV movie does have its charm, but all the TV movies they did in the 70s are very much products of their time and very, very dated. The TV movie Doctor Strange looks like John Holmes.
It also should be noted that they've also done several television animated series based on Marvel stuff over the years.
But those aren't movies.
No,
and those have actually been mostly good.
I caught a clip of the newer Ultimate Spider-Man series. Mm-hmm. I forget if the series is called that or not, but it's based on the Ultimate Spider-Man comics, and they got J. Jonah Jameson back to do
J. Jonah Jameson. They brought him back
in the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon to play...
J. Jonah Jameson?
God damn it, I'm sorry.
He played himself?
What's that actor's name? Help me out there.
I'm just being sassy. That would have been... Was it James Franco?
No.
No. Hell, I don't remember. He's brilliant, whoever he is. He's in Portal 2.
J.K. Simmons.
There we go.
J.K. Simmons.
That's the fella.
So, I mean, you mentioned Marvel movies had this curse for a while, but it really, you know, Blade did okay enough, did really well on video, but it wasn't really until, like, X-Men or, like, Spider-Man really is the one that really took off and did, like, super well in theaters.
Oh yeah, Spider-Man was phenomenal when it came out. Although Spider-Man also made me very aware of a particular phenomenon. I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design. I was part of the sequential art department, so I went to college with a number of people who have gone on to work in comics today, like, you know, Dean Tripp, whose work I highly recommend. Definitely check him out, among others. But one phenomenon I noticed during my 4 years there, anytime a Marvel comic book movie came out, everyone loved it until it came out on video, and then everyone hated it. Like Spider-Man, when Spider-Man came out, it was like a revelation. I mean, it was everything. It was pretty much everything we wanted in a Spider-Man movie. But for whatever reason, by the time it came out on DVD, everyone in the department, God, that movie sucked. But it kept happening again and again. When the Hulk came out, everyone in the department loved the Hulk until it hit DVD, and then they completely turned on it. It's fandom is weird, isn't it, Matt?
It is. You know, with Spider-Man, I saw that with a friend in the theater. It was like almost when it was out of, I didn't really want to see it, but a friend of mine named Zach, who was really into comics, kind of drugged me to it, and I never liked the casting of Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man and Kirsten Dunst as Mary Jane. I thought Tobey Maguire, even though he was like in his mid-20s at the time, he has that like sunken-in, burned-out face that looked too old. He didn't portray the youth of Peter Parker, I think, very well. And Kirsten Dunst, I don't think is not a very attractive actress, and she wasn't spunky enough for Mary Jane. So I needed more youth and more spunk is what I wanted out of Spider-Man. And I'm pretty excited for Peter Garfield in the amazing Spider-Man movie that'll be coming out this year in 2012 during the summer.
I'm going to disagree. I felt the Spider-Man movies had real sharp casting. Yes, Tobey Maguire's age did start to show, but I found that was only really true in the sequels. I did buy him. Well, once he got out of high school, I bought him as Peter Parker.
Right. Yeah, I don't. He's just an actor that has never really impressed me too much in anything. He's okay. He's very, very choosy about what he acts in. I haven't seen him in a film in years. Since Spider-Man 3, probably.
I think that's good. I'm glad he picks and chooses his roles.
Willem Dafoe is really nice as the Green Goblin. The design for that suit, God, it's okay. Looks like an action figure. So how do we want to talk about these Marvel movies? We're not going to cover, like, 30 movies in an hour. That'd be stupid.
No. We just blashed through it. I don't know. I mean,
just look at the list. Guess, you can kind of jump around what jumps out at you.
Well, I guess what I like, at least about the two things that I really like about the recent Marvel movie adaptations, one is fidelity to the source material, where, you know, clearly the people making the movies have made themselves familiar with the source material and are making it recognize. It's not like the Captain America movies from the 70s, where let's take the name Captain America but make him like Evel Knievel because Daredevils are popular. They're trying to faithfully bring these comic books and these characters and these modern legends to the screen.
Do you think part of that is because Marvel Comics created Marvel Studios in like 2008 to produce some of these Marvel films? You know, I mean, the ones running up to Avengers are Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, Thor, Captain America, the first Avenger, and, you know, the Avengers.
I think that certainly helps, and that's certainly what's facilitated actually being able to get all these characters in one movie this summer. But the other thing I like, that I love, is that with the movies, you get a blank slate, and you can do a clean, concise storytelling that isn't beholden to 50-plus years of fucking ridiculous continuity.
Well, comics reboot themselves all the time anyway. I mean,
that's my one concern with the Avengers, is now that we have a movie, like, I'm going to say it, crossovers, rampant crossovers and massive crossovers have really ruined mainstream comics as an art form. And now I'm worried that that's going to happen to the movies.
Well, one thing about the crossovers, not just crossovers, but like these stories that take 1 or 2 years to go through, is as far as comic books, I'm very casual. I would say I know a lot about comic book characters just from reading shit online, but I don't actually buy that many comics year in, year out, because every time I go into a comic book store, I get a bit intimidated. I would rather have a single graphic novel that's a story with a beginning, a middle, of an end, than to feel like I'm entering into a, you know, potential $200 investment getting 10 of these books to complete a whole big-ass story.
Yeah,
whether it's Marvel Civil War or DC 52 or the DC
New 52,
whatever, the reboot stuff they've done on a bigger scale, and Marvel's doing some of that too. Like, I don't know. As far as comic books, you know, one I really got into in high school and college was a lot of the run of the Punisher done by Garth Ennis, who I enjoyed from the Preacher comics he did. And I really enjoyed the film Punisher Warzone. Even though it was a colossal flop, it's technically the third Punisher movie. It's directed by German director Lexi Alexander. Hey, did you ever get to see this one, Thrasher?
Wait, which one was it?
Punisher Warzone.
Oh, no, regrettably I didn't. There's a very favorable episode of How Did This Get Made about it, so I am going to seek it out. But no, I have not seen it as of this time.
It really takes the tone of the Garth Ennis stuff, I think, much better than the Punisher film a few years earlier starring Thomas Jane did. It sets to New York, it's gritty, it's bloody, it's ridiculous. The Punisher has almost no dialogue. It is like an ultra-violent sort of mob movie. It works really well. And you have a scene where there are these bad guys that do parkour, where they do all these gymnastics, jumping on buildings and stuff. And the Punisher takes out a rocket launcher and shoots a rocket at them and explodes them in the middle of an acrobatic routine. And no reason. It's just the Punisher wreaking violence, which I think fits with the relative simplicity of that character. What out of this list of films based on Marvel Comics, what is one that jumps out at you, Thrasher? For good, for better, or for worse?
Okay, I am gonna. I really like 2003's Hulk. I think that is a fantastic movie. That is an ambitious movie.
Directed by Ang Lee.
Yeah, by Ang Lee. Yep. I love that he took a classic Marvel character and used it to tell a story that has actual emotional relevance and that tries to examine the human condition, which is one feature that most of the other Marvel movies, even to this day, lack.
I have not seen that since I saw it in the theater. I saw it with my buddy Zach, the one that took me to see Spider-Man and X-Men, for that matter. And we snuck in beers in the theater, and it was a late-at-night show. Might have been opening night. Certainly, I believe it was opening weekend. And, right, it's a more thoughtful, intelligent picture. Bruce Banner doesn't even become the Hulk until, like, over half an hour into the film. I mean, you're not kidding when you say it's ballsy.
Yeah, I like that. I really appreciate films that are willing to take a leisurely pace.
I thought the story kind of went all over the place. I don't know. I think more of a focused story would have worked. It felt like there was a lot of script rewrites, which I'm sure there were. But, I mean, one pattern. We mentioned Marvel Studios doing, like, the recent Iron Man and the Incredible Hulk film. A lot of those Marvel Studio films have the same basic plot, and that it's an origin story in which, at the end of it, the good guy has to fight a bad guy that's basically like an evil clone of the good guy.
Well, that's something that has long been part of the Marvel universe is that it's never just been good versus evil escapist fantasy. The heroes and villains have always had a personal stake in what's going on. One of the reasons that Doctor Doom is such a brilliant villain is that his life is intimately connected with the life of the Fantastic Four. One of the reasons why the various goblins are such good villains is that their lives are intricately tied to the life of Peter Parker. And frankly, I like that. I like when the hero has a real personal stake in the conflict, and it's not just some sort of weak revenge motivation.
Yeah, and that's really the tricky thing about the first film in most of these comic book films end up being, you know, part of a franchise as they get sequels and so forth, and that the origin takes up so much of the plot that, you know, do you go from there? And the rest of it feels like a half-assed kind of rush to the finish line.
Well, that is one advantage that the Marvel Universe has over the DC Universe, is that in the DC Universe, the origin stories are almost incidental. It's just some quick exposition to explain why the hero's there. But with the Marvel Universe, the origin stories are fulfilling stories in and of themselves.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, you can't tell, I mean, you really can't tell the origin of Spider-Man without the origin of the Goblin. I mean, Spider-Man's origin has a beginning, middle, and an end. I mean, you could probably just do a movie about him learning that with great power comes great responsibility and not even get any supervillains involved.
Right, and another problem with these comic book films from Marvel is sometimes, with things like X-Men, and I think we'll see with Avengers, is you have so many different characters trying to juggle them all in a satisfying narrative can be a problem.
I'm hoping they don't waste too much time getting the team together. That's one of my that's one of my concerns, because, like, I've already seen, you know, all these other superhero movies. I understand who these characters are. I understand why they might very well get together. Like, I hope we get to the fireworks factory early. I hope that it's not, how are we going to get these people to join up? That's crazy. I mean, that was one of the flaws in the Justice League animated series. I really felt that its first episode took too long to actually get the Justice League founded.
Hmm.
I felt that the story either needed to be stretched out over three episodes or needed to be 5 minutes and then the rest of the story.
You know, although as a whole, I liked the recent X-Men film, X-Men First Class.
That's quite good.
Yeah, but I did feel the members of the X-Men, aside from Magneto, Professor X, and Mystique, were pretty lame. Like the little kid X-Men or whatever, like it was like a real like D-grade level of X-Men on the team.
Well, they're in a weird position where they couldn't exactly use some of the core team members that we traditionally associate with the X-Men. And I also think they were hamstrung because like Cyclops was such a weak character in the first three X-Men films.
Yeah,
I really felt they had nothing without Jean Grey. They felt they had nothing they could do with him, so they just left him out of the movie. But overall, I loved X-Men First Class, and it did something that I've been waiting for quite a long time to see. And that's a superhero movie that's a period piece. So many of the old Marvel comics are a product of their time or have their roots in a particular time. I really felt it was a terrible mistake to set the first Fantastic Four film in the modern day. It really should take place in the 1960s during the height of the Cold War.
I mean, for X-Men First Class, you know, they're in production right now for a sequel to X-Men First Class. Are they going to call it X-Men Second Class? I know that'd be my
summer
guess.
School.
Summer, spring break, X-Men spring break.
Graduate studies.
Graduate studies. X-Men thesis.
Doctorate review.
Fantastic Four. I've never read much of the Fantastic Four comics. I've read a few of them, like the crossovers with the old Spider-Man issues. And the comedic tone, I didn't really appreciate, but then I'm not coming from it as some guy that's read the comics either. I thought Fantastic Four Rise of Silver Surfer was better, but it still wasn't a group of heroes I really jibed with, and supposedly Fox is trying to reboot it to go with a more darker take. I mean, what did the Ultimate take on Fantastic Four? How is that? Did you read any of that?
I did. Okay, I don't. This is a problem I've had with the Marvel and DC universes for quite a while now. I like the idea of their characters more than I like any of the comics that they're actually producing. And I know that means I'm probably overlooking a lot of great stuff, but I'm just not interested in investing in what they're doing in the comic books with those characters now, in part because of, you know, the crazy continuity and the reboots and the alternate timelines. I love them, but I'm not in love with them.
Did you think Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer was better than the first film?
I've actually never seen the first Fantastic Four film. That being said, I really liked Rise of the Silver Surfer. And I think the thing I liked the most about it is that it was almost... It felt exactly like a classic Fantastic Four comic from the late 60s, early 70s. The characterization was perfect. The conflicts were perfect. It just felt like I was watching one of my favorite classic comic books, all the way down to Doctor Doom trying to steal the power cosmic and the Fantastic Four getting their powers screwed up. That's classic Fantastic Four.
I mean, Babylon 5 creator and writer J. Michael Straczynski even scripted a screenplay for a Silver Surfer spin-off movie that they seem to be close to being making, but Fantastic Four Rise of Silver Surfer, while still making, worldwide, like, almost $300 million off a budget of $130 million, for whatever reason, Fox decided not to do a Silver Surfer film. But that has to be what their intention was at the time.
There has been a Silver Surfer film in development for quite some time. That being said, if you like the Silver Surfer, definitely check out the Silver Surfer animated series from the early 90s. From the late 90s. Late 90s. I think it was 98, 99. It's fantastic. It is true to Jack Kirby's art style. It has just the right level of pretension.
Yeah, I mean, what I've read of the original Silver Surfer comics reminded me of the original Thor comics. And that their language was a bit more purple prose, a bit more florid, a bit more Shakespearean sounding. I don't theatrical.
It's almost like, you know, when you're reading a Silver Surfer story, it really is like a cross between a Greek tragedy and a medieval passion play.
Yeah, which makes
I think it is appropriate.
It makes it, you know, tricky to transition to film. And speaking of sort of the passion plays. let's talk about Thor for a second.
Okay.
I saw this in the theater. I love the stuff in Asgard. How do you pronounce that?
Asgard is an acceptable pronunciation.
Okay, Asgard. And the different planets and stuff in the beginning. But the stuff on Earth in New Mexico, I thought felt and sounded cheap. Whether it was the shield base that was like plastic wrap on top of corridors.
A crater.
Or like, you know, the big confrontation between Thor and this thing that looked kind of like a aluminum Iron Man that shot fire. I thought was all that stuff on Earth was really underwhelming, and I wish they would have kept the whole fantasy. I like the fantasy Lord of the Rings intergalactic stuff better than the Earthbound action and storyline.
I don't know. I felt the film was overall successful, and again, it felt like a classic Marvel comic book. They got the characterization just right. I frankly, the only thing I didn't like about the movie was all the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. And
it feels a bit forced in some of those Marvel stuff, doesn't it?
Well, I realize they're trying to set it up for the Avengers movie, but at the same time, I don't think you need that much of it. I mean, to the point where you have a character who is presumably Hawkeye, who is only there to do absolutely nothing. And I did feel that when Thor was exiled to Earth, they did make him a little bit too much of a chump the number of times he got knocked down and sedated. It kind of turned into bad comedy.
Yeah, a very broad comedy. I think it's interesting to note that worldwide, the theatrical gross, Thor made almost $100 million more than Captain America. Which part of that, Captain America having America in the name, I think probably makes it a tougher sell overseas. You know,
I don't. Well, I mean, it is. You know, without trying to be ironic or anything, it is. Captain America is a very American character, and yeah. it probably doesn't translate over to another country. But likewise, you know, every other countries have their own mythological figures, their own superheroes, and those probably wouldn't translate too well if you tried to show those in America. There would be a bit of an inevitable culture clash. People who saw it at all would probably see it more as a curiosity.
Let's go back in the Wayback Machine a bit. What were your thoughts on Daredevil, starring Ben Affleck?
Well, it was okay. It was one of the most okay movies I saw that year. not to say, like, it was... You know what I felt? That would have made a great pilot for a Daredevil TV series.
Yeah.
It didn't quite feel worthy of being a full theatrical movie. That being said, Michael Clark Duncan was the perfect Kingpin.
It's very inspired. Oh, you know, at the time on the internet, a lot of people complained because Kingpin in the comics is white.
Like, how can fuck them! He was perfect!
But whatever. No, exactly. They're saying, how can you cast a black guy in the part? But yeah, I don't know. Even though they didn't do much with Kingpin in the film, I think it was really smart casting. There is like a director's cut.
He had
cut.
The presence. He had the menace. Yes. He had the voice.
No, I totally agree. And there's like a director's cut of Daredevil, which I understand is a lot better. And rated R even. But I've never seen it.
Really?
It was really straight to video. I just never got around to it because it wasn't crazy. This is, according to Wikipedia, this is sort of interesting. Instead of Ben Affleck, originally Vin Diesel was considered to be Daredevil.
I think I heard that.
I think that would have worked better.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I could buy Vin Diesel as a lawyer.
Do you like the red latex look they had for the Daredevil costume?
It was, you know, I did, but that's because it looked kind of pulp. It looked classic, kind of almost classic pulp hero.
Yeah. Well, this is related to Marvel Comics. I'm sorry we're jumping around so much, but if you want to... Do you want to jump in first, or...?
No, where are you going?
Oh, okay. So, you know, in 2012, February 26th, I turned 30 years old. And it's been a little bit of...
Renew!
And I've been a bit of a tradition for my birthday here in Portland, Oregon, to go with some friends to see some Nicolas Cage stuff. And I decided we would watch it, have a, eat a lot of pizza, drink a lot of beer, watch Ghost Rider 1 on Blu-ray at my house, which I bought specially for the occasion. I should have rented it. And then we went to the theater for a late night show to see Ghost Rider 2, Spirit of Vengeance. So a Ghost Rider double feature, if you will. And I've actually read some of the original Ghost Rider comics, and I find those very enjoyable. Again, it has similar art to the Tomb of Dracula comics. I bet it's the same artist, even. It's certainly the same writers. And the first Ghost Rider film with Nicolas Cage, I thought was cheesy, poorly paced. The special effects, especially by today's standards, look awful. But Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance, I surprisingly enjoyed. It's very light on plot. It's directed by Neville Dean and Taylor, who directed the Crank movies with Jason Statham. And it's just insane. The tone of the thing is crazy. It's not as crazy as if it would have been a rated R film. But have you seen any of the Ghost Rider films, Thrasher?
You know, I haven't. Ghost Rider is one of those characters that I've never been all that into, so I just comfortably let those films pass me by. Now, of course, if they do a new Fantastic Four film adaptation where Ghost Rider is part of the team, then I'll probably check that out.
Was Ghost Rider ever part of the Fantastic Four?
There was a period, I want to say it was in the early 80s, when they were trying, where, you know, Marvel was trying to reinvigorate itself, and they did, like, the new Fantastic Four. If I remember correctly, the roster was, like, Ghost Rider, Wolverine, Moon Knight, and some other schmuck.
Hmm.
Possibly Night Shredder.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to give you an idea of the craziness and the tone of the sequel, Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance, and Nicolas Cage did the motion capture for Ghost Rider in the sequel, and you can tell it's very bizarre. There's a scene where Johnny Blaze...
Oh, here we go. The new Fantastic Four was the Hulk, Spider-Man, Wolverine, and Ghost Rider 2.
Weird. Okay. There's a scene in Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance where the Ghost Rider goes up to just like some like thug with a machine gun and lifts him up by the edge of his jacket and just stares him in the eyes and cranks his head at these weird angles. And he stares at this guy for like 4 minutes and nothing happens. Meanwhile, there's intense heavy metal music in the background. All the bad guys around him are like, what is he going to do? We don't know what's happening. And Ghost Rider ends up killing him. But it's like 4 minutes of a flaming skull head staring at a scared fat man. And just the balls to do a scene like that for 4 minutes in which nothing happens. And just the insanity of the tone of some of that film. I found very, very enjoyable.
I do respect those directors for how far they're willing to push things.
Oh, yeah. No, they're not afraid of pushing things. You know, Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance did much better overseas than it did in the U.S. Maybe we'll see a Ghost Rider 3. I don't know. I'm sure Nicolas Cage needs the money. He's sold off several of his houses and has done a whole lot of films very often recently. Although some
hasn't sold off any of his fossils, though.
No, none of his fossils. Although his son has been writing some comic books, as I understand. But
cool.
Yeah. Look back at this list of live-action Marvel films. What's something that jumps out, Thrasher?
Oh, gosh. Well, actually... Something that jumps out for how little it jumps out is Man-Thing, which I believe was originally a House of Mystery character. This was going to be a theatrical release, but during the course of its production was downgraded to direct to television.
Have you seen it?
You know, no, I haven't.
Okay, I have not seen it.
I didn't have cable when it came out, so it passed me by.
I haven't seen it either, but at the time the comic Man-Thing came out, was it meant to be a ripoff of Swamp Thing?
Oh, here we go. Savage Tales. That was the origin. I don't think it was specifically meant to, but how many plant-based, you know, but any time you do a kind of plant-based monster from a swamp, it's going to, they're going to echo each other.
Right. And they did make two Swamp Thing movies in a TV series. Swamp Thing is DC, though. That's not Marvel.
Yeah, that is indeed DC. Right. Very much DC.
Yep.
We'll have to talk about those films later.
Certainly. Spider-Man 3 is a movie, a Marvel movie that pisses off a lot of people.
Yeah, it had a lot of villain bloat. I can respect that they left Gwen Stacy out of the first Spider-Man movie, if only to make the story tighter. Although that being said, having the hero lose his love interest in the first film would have been very daring. But putting her in after he's got Mary Jane, it was a love triangle that didn't quite work. I felt they didn't use Venom to Venom's full potential. Certainly didn't use Osborn as the Goblin to that full potential.
Yeah, originally
Likewise,
in early
Sandman.
Originally in early drafts of Spider-Man 3, it was supposed to be Sandman and the Vulture, and they cast Ben Kingsley as the Vulture.
That would have been pretty damn cool.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, director and writer Sam Raimi is more of a fan of the older Spider-Man stuff, but then the producers, specifically Avi Arad, who's like the Marvel producer dude, was telling him, oh, you gotta really have Venom, he's a fan favorite character. And it's you have a lot of different characters, and you include a whole new romantic interest of sorts with Gwen Stacy. There's a lot going on in this film.
The other thing that kind of sticks at me, Spider-Man becomes really unlikable and becomes way too much of an asshole for way too much of the film.
He punches Mary Jane in the face.
And when I see Topher Grace, there's a part of me that's wondering, why isn't Topher Grace playing Peter Parker? I bet he'd be quite good.
I agree. Topher Grace is really enjoyable as, as Eddie Brock. And then one problem I have with some of these superhero movies is, you know, when he's Venom, there's some scenes where he has the head, the human head. But like
the CGI body.
And the CGI or costume body. And I have a problem with that in Iron Man, where it's Robert Downey Jr.'s head on top of the Iron Man body. And I think it looks like real fake and cheesy because it's a human live-action head on top of a bunch of CGI.
It makes you wonder how he actually fits in that suit.
Yeah, that too. The whole mathematics of the musculature of the person versus the suit and all this stuff.
But the other thing about that final, for now, Spider-Man movie was I couldn't help thinking that I really wanted to see the Lizard or Mysterio, or hell, why not? If you're going to make it a trilogy, why not just do the Sinister Six?
That'd be expensive, a lot of bad guys, a lot of special effects.
Yeah, but I think they could have done it. I mean, if they were able to do Avengers.
Yeah.
Although actually, you know how Bruce Campbell had cameos in all the Spider-Man movies?
Yeah.
This was a rumor among the fans that I so wish had been true, but there was a long running rumor that Mysterio was going to show up in a later film, and that he was going to be played by Bruce Campbell, and it was going to be revealed that Bruce Campbell and all the other films, that was always Mysterio. And I thought that would have been so awesome to pull something off like that.
Right. I mean, writer-director Sam Raimi, they were going to do a fourth Spider-Man film with Tobey Maguire. Part of the reason it didn't happen is it would have been really expensive. What they had planned, reportedly, for the villain is they would have had John Malkovich play the Vulture, and Anne Hathaway would have played Felicia Hardy, who, instead of the Black Cat, would have become a new character called the Vulturess.
Yeah, that's not what you want to do.
No.
You don't want to invent... When you have a character with such a rich rogues gallery as Spider-Man, if you have to invent a villain for your movie, you are doing something wrong.
Yeah, they also were planning on doing a Venom spinoff off this film, which didn't happen.
Now that could have worked.
Yeah, it could have. So in Spider-Man 3, I mean, made a fuckload of money. It did extremely well. But Sony decided eventually, because they couldn't work out the same Raimi themes, and probably to do the film at a lower budget. And, you know, to give you an idea, Spider-Man 3 had a budget of $258 million. One of the most more expensive films of that time. And The Amazing Spider-Man has a budget of... Let me look that up. Let me see if I can find that. But it's less than $258 million, I can tell you that much.
Well, I mean, hopefully they'll do right by it. Although, as I understand it, they're going to tell Spider-Man's origin story again. And despite what I've said about how important that origin story is to that character and how it's a story, a satisfying narrative in and of itself,
yeah,
I am tired of seeing origin stories in superhero movies. I already am totally familiar with the character's origins. I really wish you could just jump in media res and just get on to the fireworks factory.
Right. Okay, so I said the budget on Spider-Man 3 is like $280 million. I guess the according to an article, the estimated budget on The Amazing Spider-Man, the new one, is $220 million. So it's less. And, I mean, you don't have any big-name actors, but it's a lot of special effects, certainly. So, a lot of Marvel movies out there.
Especially with all the direct-to-DVD animated things they're doing now.
Oh, yeah. And what do you think about the whole motion comic thing? They've been doing a lot of these direct-to-video things where they take a comic book, take the artwork from the comic book, kind of loosely animate it, kind of shake it around a little bit, do some lip-syncing, do full voice acting and music. And it's a cheaper way than doing a full animated film, but they've done it based on things like Iron Man Extremis, or the Joss Whedon X-Men run from a few years ago, and all those sort of things. Have you seen any of those? Or
I have not. Although I've seen like similar things in the past, motion comics, animated comics,
yeah.
You know, things like that. They're never all that satisfying because it is such a half step.
Exactly. It looks cheap, although it's neat. I mean, you know, the artwork in a comic book is bound to look a lot more detailed and interesting and nuanced than the art, I think, in an animated film, where they got to do so much more artwork from frame to frame and all this stuff. Have you seen any of the animated direct-to-video Marvel stuff?
You know, I only saw the end of one of their Avengers movies, whichever one had Giant Man crash into Paris, I think it was. I just in general, I'm not that interested in those movies.
I saw a bit of their first, you know, kind of like relaunch direct to video one called Ultimate Avengers the Movie, and
have been the one I saw the ending of.
Yeah, it might have been. Oh, yeah, it looks like it was. Because I worked at a video store at the time, I could watch all this stuff for free, and I thought while the artwork was good, I thought the animation looked a bit stiff, and it had this stuff with Captain America during World War II. And I thought, ooh, he's going to fight Nazis, but then it turns out, oh no, the Nazis are actually being led by aliens with all this other shit. And I was like, well, that makes it less interesting for me.
Well, I'm already turned off.
Yeah.
Now that I hear that.
But in it, it did have some of the classic storyline, which I bet they'll have in this new Avengers film. It wasn't the very first issue of the Avengers comics, a bunch of the superheroes working to try and contain the Hulk from wrecking a city.
Matt?
Yes, Thrasher?
I don't know, there was a gap there.
Oh, I was asking you a question.
Oh, frankly, I do not know what event brought the Avengers together. It is a gap in my comic book knowledge.
Okay, well, whether it was the first issue or not, it was a very early storyline in the Avengers comic book of the Avengers having to work together to contain the Hulk from taking out a city. And, so that's something.
Have we plumbed the depths of a mighty Marvel movieverse?
I think we got 10 more minutes, more or less. How do we do this?
I don't know. I guess, in the future, we're looking at another set of sequels for Iron Man and Thor, Captain America, Spider-Man. And apparently they're finally going to do a Wolverine spinoff. Another Wolverine spinoff.
Yeah, right. And it's supposed to be based on the run of comics where it was Wolverine in Japan.
Which could be kind of cool.
Fighting against Silver Samurai and a bunch of ninjas. There's some romance. Lady Deathstrike. There's romance in there. So, yeah, I think that could be pretty interesting. X-Men Wolverine I thought was okay. I liked, or X-Men Origins Wolverine, rather. I liked Gambit in there. I recognized some of the characters, but I think Deadpool and, yeah, I don't know. I think the plot as a whole, and the special effects especially, were really kind of lackluster. It was a real rushed film, it appears.
Yeah, I guess my concern, you know, going into the future is that there might be a certain amount of oversaturation.
So do you think, with this first Avengers movie coming out, there's been plot threads, in some cases subtle, and some others not so subtle, in these different Marvel films leading up to the Avengers. Do you think they're going to do that same thing leading up to the Avengers 2?
I'm sure there will. I'm sure there will be some... Well, actually, what I suspect, because it's now a tradition that after the credits of every movie, there's some hint of what's coming in the future.
Yes.
So I suspect that that after the credits of the Avengers, we're rather than getting a taste of the next of a future Avengers movie, we'll probably have some sort of taste of what's going to set up the conflicts in the future Iron Man, Thor, and Captain America.
Hmm.
Although this is something that's rather interesting. A friend of mine who lives overseas has already seen the film. It's already premiered in
the
Avengers
time
zone.
Yeah,
the Avengers. And she posted online that when the credits started rolling, 3/4 of the audience left the theater, and all she could think was, have they learned absolutely nothing from the last 7 Marvel films that have come out?
Yeah, and it should be mentioned, The Avengers is co-written and directed by Joss Whedon, who produced such TV series as Firefly and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel.
Yeah.
All those other, you know, series working with large ensembles of characters and a geek favorite. So I've heard a lot of really good things. You know, one of our followers on Twitter, Jade Craven, who is the girlfriend of a listener to the show, said that she saw The Avengers. She said, it was so awesome. I loved it. As a geek, it was awesome. It had all the silly stuff and infighting that you would expect. I'm going to see it again in the theaters to catch it in 2D. So,
I will probably also see it in 2D. 3D, with the exception of certain animated films, 3D just is not doing it for me.
I agree, 3D is not doing it for me. I'm going to catch it after work tomorrow. A bunch of my friends want to catch it, you know, on the opening weekend in the U.S., May 4th, 2012. But they want to see it, like, at noon. And, like, I work Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 3 in the afternoon. Like, I can't, I don't even have the vacation to take off half a day of work to see a movie. So I'm just going to catch it by myself after work. I can use my parking at work and walk to a theater down the block. And it turns out the soonest time is in 3D, so I'll just happen to catch the 3D one.
Yeah.
But I agree that... How much is it to see a movie in 3D in Kentucky?
Too much. I mean, it's too much everywhere. What's awesome is there's a nice little theater just a few blocks from where I'm living where you can see a movie for $5 or for $4 on a Tuesday. They do discounts on Tuesday. No 3D, but you don't really need 3D. It's a nice small cozy theater.
Just a one screener, or
it's really helping me reconnect with film going. What was that?
Well, you know, film going is an interesting thing. I was meeting some friends of the family who had kids that were like, I know, but they had a kid that was like 11 and a kid that was 13. And he was saying when he takes his kids to the theater, his kids don't understand what's the point of seeing a movie in a theater when they can watch it at home, high definition on Blu-ray, or they can watch it on YouTube, or they can watch it on Netflix instantly, or they can watch it on their phone. What do you get out of seeing it in a theater and paying more money for it?
Assholes in the audience.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there is, when the theater experience is a good experience, it really is transcendent and it really can make the appreciation of films better. But damned if both the studios, the theaters themselves, and the audience haven't been just savaging and destroying the theater-going experience.
I get very distracted when people check on their phones or text message during movies or whatever, or even talk on the phone during movies. Because I tend to be very sensitive to that sort of thing, and so I'll notice the phone screen light up. It takes my focus away from the film. I miss what's going on in the movie.
I get up and confront people.
Do you? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
You get a bit pissy, huh?
No, I don't get pissy. I just explain to them that they should stop what they're doing.
Hmm.
And if they continue to make an issue out of it, then I will go to management, and it's... And then if it keeps escalating, it kind of becomes either they leave or I do. And then we see where it goes from there.
I see.
You know, like, I don't care if you waste your $12, but don't you dare waste my $12.
What about people talking during the movie?
Yeah, I don't like that.
You don't? No.
No matter how bad the movie is, I don't like that.
I do think, I thought at the time with DVD, but certainly I think in the case with high-definition TVs and watching things in Blu-ray or whatever, even a good quality high-definition stream, the quality at home, the picture quality and sound quality to me seems much better than in theaters. And part of it is when you're watching a film projected on film as opposed to digital, the picture quality gets worse and worse each time. And I was watching, you familiar with The Nerdist? You know what that is?
Yeah, I know Nerdist.
Chris Hardwick runs it. It's a series of podcasts, and they also do a series of shows on YouTube now. One of the shows they do is Ain't It Cool, based on the website, you know, starring Harry Knowles, who's the founder and a writer on the site, movie gossip and stuff. And he did an episode where he had on special effects artist Douglas Trumbull.
Very cool.
Who has worked on things like Star Wars, 2001, The Space Odyssey, and so on. And he was explaining, so usually you see a movie in a movie theater, and usually they don't have the light, the lamp, and the projector as, you know, to the full strength it should be. Now, you take a movie in 3D, they have to use a different lens. That cuts the light down by 25%. By 50%. Mm-hmm. And then you have people wear 3D glasses. That cuts down the light another 50%. So you're already seeing a film at 25% of the brightness level it should be. And you factor that in combined with people setting the brightness levels wrong to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff in 3D or 3D glasses often looks super dark because the theaters aren't calibrated correctly to make up for that.
That has me so incredibly turned on right now.
Does it? You have a nerd boner? I mean, what do you think about it? Have you noticed that when seeing stuff in 3D where it looks kind of murky and out of focus or tough to make out?
Only once, I think.
Oh, okay. I've noticed it a bit more. I mean, certainly with the modern 3D stuff, even though it works better as far as making stuff pop out, having depth of field, than the old red and blue flimsy 3D glasses... the problem is, for me, is I'll get a headache after 20 minutes, and I'll have to close my eyes for a minute just to rest. Because it's so much I'm concentrating on the screen to process all that information. And maybe little kids watching the new 3D stuff don't have that problem. I don't know.
I have not yet had that problem.
Then what is your problem with the modern 3D process, which you've talked a little bit about on the SequelCast 3D movie episode? But I mean,
that it's generally it's just not much of an enhancement. There's just not enough films that bring a level of artistry to it. You know, and it's one of those things. A kinetic scene done in 2D, done right, can be just as thrilling and exciting as it done in 3D. It's too many sprinkles on a cake is how I feel about it.
Hmm.
I like having a few sprinkles, but after a while it's just excessive. And you start to realize that sprinkles on their own taste like wax.
I think, some of the 3D still in Avatar, even though they came out quite a few years ago, is probably some of the best done with the new process. Because there was a lot of real work put into that, regardless of the quality of the film itself. Yeah. Okay, so... I think
so Marvel!
What?
Marvel!
Marvel, Marvel, Marvel.
Yes, true believer. I can't believe I only just now did my Stan Lee impersonation.
I think it's interesting looking at this list. You know, so what, Kick-Ass is kind of a Marvel film because it was Icon Comics as an imprint of Marvel?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Or,
yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know who published Kick-Ass. But apparently it's connected. I don't know if Icon Comics is an imprint of Marvel, but the studio apparently had connections to Marvel. But it's not the Marvel universe, so it really doesn't count. Likewise, Men in Black has never been part of the Marvel Universe, so even though Marvel Entertainment's been connected to it, and Marvel Entertainment owns the original Men in Black comic books from when they bought out Malibu, it's not part of the Marvel Universe. It's not really a Marvel movie.
Right. So, I mean, let's wrap things up on this note. What Marvel comic character would you like to see come to the big screen? And it could be one they've already done that you'd like to see rebooted or whatever. Or it could be something new.
Gosh.
Because there's so many Marvel characters to choose from.
Yeah. Well, you know, looking... I would actually really like to see the Inhumans.
Now, that was Jack Kirby was behind that, right?
Yeah, they were a group of superhumans that were... They were originally introduced in the Fantastic Four. That's one of the things that, like... Their introduction to the Marvel Universe is so tightly connected to the Fantastic Four that it would be tricky to do... It would be tricky to do a movie about them that follows their original story arc that doesn't mention the Fantastic Four frequently. It really would be, to do it without getting the Fantastic Four involved, you really would have to do it in media res. But I really like the characters. I think they're quirky. They're just a nice kind of bizarre super team.
Who's the bad guy they're up against?
Usually themselves. Because the thing is, they're not a superhero team. They're a population that are all... They're a population of demi-humans that are all superpowered.
Huh.
That live in an isolated community. Depending on what era of Marvel you're reading, it might be in the Arctic, it might be on the moon.
I see.
How about you?
You know, I'm not as familiar with the comics as you guys are, but I think I would like to see, kind of like we mentioned earlier, a Tomb of Dracula movie.
That would be pretty cool. There was a Tomb of Dracula animated pilot made.
I read that. I've never seen that, but it looked interesting. And I'm not sure how tonally, if you would make Tomb of Dracula something campy, like one of the Grindhouse films that Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez did, like Death Proof or whatever.
Oh, I'd love that.
I'm not sure if you do it self-consciously campy. If you would kind of make it ultra serious, but in a retro setting, but I think certainly the 70s outfits, like a Mod Squad meets Buffy or something, might be the way to do it. I don't know. Because Dracula is public domain, so.
Oh, yeah. But Tomb of Dracula is not.
Right. And so I think that's what I would do. Maybe not the most inspired choice, but.
It would be fun. I mean, like, I would like to see them dip into some of the outliers of the Marvel Universe. Because there's still rich stories there.
She-Hulk.
Oh, that would be... There was in the early 90s a She-Hulk film in development. Sadly, never went anywhere. The trick is, which era of She-Hulk do you do? Do you do the early She-Hulk, where she is kind of a monster? Do you do the John Byrne 80s self-referential snarky She-Hulk that has crazy adventures? Or do you do the She-Hulk as a lawyer? Like she is now.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, speaking of the Avengers, we can tie things off on this. I think this is a classic sort of way to do this thing. Did you see there's like an Avengers porn film?
Yes, the trailer's fantastic. China plays the She-Hulk. They couldn't have made a better choice.
XXX Avengers, is that it?
I believe so.
Wait, no, that's a different one.
Well, the one with China is the one I'm thinking of.
But there's a lot more women in that version than in the actual film, The Avengers, right?
Well, yeah, but that's one thing I love. I love that in the porno, they've actually looked into the deeper Marvel Universe to find more female Avengers members to bring in.
Maybe I should contact the company to see if they'll send us a review copy.
That would be pretty damn cool.
Should try. Yeah, no, I'm looking at the poster now. It's a great... takeoff on the official poster.
Audience, we are looking at something fantastic.
Oh, yes. Axel Braun's The Avengers XXX, a porn parody by Vivid. You have Iron Man, Thor, Black Widow, Hawkeye, Scarlet Witch, Spider-Woman, Ms. Marvel, Spider-Man, the Hulk, and Nick Fury.
That's going to be great.
I think so. Yeah, Vivid has been doing a lot of, like, porn stuff that has really good costumes and set designs.
I like that they're getting some production value in there.
I think so, too. It's pretty cool. All right, man. Well, I think we've talked plenty about different Marvel films in this sequel cast special episode.
It would appear so.
Very good. So, so next time on the sequel cast, you'll be hearing a... I don't know. I don't know if it'll be the commentary.
Incomprehensible babbling.
Yeah, it'll be an episode of sequel cast. Next time on sequel cast. So... For the sequel cast, this is Matt.
And true believer, William Thrasher.
Saying ta-ta.
Excelsior.
Excelsior, ta-ta for now.